Now, we've heard reports in recent days that the number of vacancies on certain jobs and recruitment sites have returned to pre-pandemic levels. But we imagine that what people are looking for in a job has changed drastically over the last 18 months or so. To talk us through this, I'm joined on the line now by Caroline Reedy. She's Managing Director at the HR Suite. Caroline, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Ciara. Great to be talking to you on this gorgeous afternoon.
Oh, it's beautiful, beautiful, beautiful day. Now, if people are job hunting, they'll clearly have, you know, their red lines, and that could be in terms of salary or hours of operation, but there are always those little sweeteners or those little extra benefits in terms of culture, working practice, perhaps upskilling or training opportunities that could sweeten the deal. How has that kind of landscape changed over recent years?
I think with the fact that so many people got the opportunity to work remotely, Ciara, during the pandemic, one of the best things to come out of the whole situation was the fact that many employees have proved that remote working can and does work. And as employers are now advertising, we've seen 77% of recent jobs being advertised based on jobs. Irish Jobs there have said that remote working now is a huge part of advertising those jobs. So it's really positive, I think, and it's a big prerequisite now for people to see a blended approach to remote working. Some in the office, and people love the benefits of going in, meeting colleagues, the learning, you know, the whole element of interaction. But people are really used to the fact now that they don't have the commute, they can work where they want, they have the work-life balance piece that, you know, they can do the jobs in the middle of the day, they don't have the commute. And I think that's probably the biggest change and the most significant one now going forward.
Are there some sectors of the economy who perhaps haven't onboarded itself with remote working as much possibly as it could? Because I know that it will only suit certain kinds of positions. You can't be a retail assistant from your living room.
No, absolutely. There's certain jobs, obviously, that this is going to really suit, like people who are working in offices, the finance sector, call centres, you know, all those type of office-based jobs. But even in other areas now, like retail assistants, hotel-type positions, people are looking at more flexible ways of working. So, for example, people may work three longer days and have more free time off. And this is something now that people are finding more attractive to suit, again, that work-life balance that people found, I think, during the pandemic and don't want to give up now.
Are there certain kinds of employers who are kind more predisposed to that kind of move in working terms and conditions? Because you would imagine that startups may be more likely to be a little bit more flexible to play around with what might suit their staff or the particular kind of talent they're looking for. And maybe larger companies are in a better position to respond to those kind of employees' soft needs, if you will, than other kinds of firms.
I think that employers are so aware now that it's really, really hard to get great talent, and also the whole piece of retaining the talent you have, that if it's a case that they don't facilitate the blended approach in jobs that are amenable to it, I think that they're missing a huge opportunity around that retention and attraction piece, because others will just say, okay, well, look, if I am going to get it here and the job can be done remotely and blended, as I say, that hybrid model particularly is where most companies are landing, then they're going elsewhere and they're job hunting. But you're spot on. I think startups can offer that flexibility and they may not have had the same level of office space available to them, so they automatically used that hybrid model. But one of the things we're really seeing as well, Ciara, is that people have relocated to working hubs remotely around the country. So people have relocated to places like Kerry, Mayo, Donegal, you know, and they're really taking advantage of lower cost of living, and then they don't mind going into wherever that office is, whether it's in Dublin or somewhere else, for the couple of days that need to facilitate that. But they're getting kind of, I suppose, an overall better package as far as they're concerned.
It'll be interesting to see, Caroline, how the remote working situation revolves, if at all, once the commercial leases that a lot of these companies may be currently tied into expire.
Absolutely, and a lot of companies already are changing how the office looks and feels. So we have a lot of clients now that rather than everyone having had in the past, everyone had their desk, now they're looking at hot desking, people booking a desk when they come in, obviously maintaining social distancing and maintaining hygiene, you know, etc. But people are definitely thinking about the fact that we don't need a desk for everybody because everybody's not going to be in the office. And there's a big cost saving in relation to that once you have the right setup. Because remember, if everybody has a desk in the office and a desk at home, they both need to be ergonomically suitable. The employer is obliged to do a risk assessment to make sure people have the right equipment to work at home and in the office. So if you're doubling up, it's going to be a costly exercise for a lot of employers.
I would imagine the recruitment piece is one part of the puzzle. Retention in certain situations, Caroline, can be a completely different matter. And I would imagine that there are three key pillars there: career advancement, benefits, and culture.
Yeah, said like a real HR professional there, Kira, because they're the things that we absolutely would be advocating. And I suppose tied into that culture piece is the connectedness, which, you know, people feel part of that culture and part of that organisation. And as people have been, and those that even haven't been working remotely have been working in, you know, different types of environments, that, you know, their canteen hasn't really been in operation to the same extent, etc. We're definitely now, as HR practitioners, working with employers to say, how can we redevelop the connectedness, yes, in line with COVID restrictions, etc. But it's really important because, you know, for a lot of people, that they really miss that piece of, you know, the culture, the core values, and that connectedness that make them really loyal to that company, which we need to reignite again.
Well, Caroline Reedy, Managing Director of the HR Suite, thank you indeed for joining us. Now, there are thousands of people waiting to get their hands on their digital COVID-19 certificate. And to talk us through this, I'm joined on the line by Fionn Davenport, Editor-in-Chief at the Irish Travel Trade Network. Fionn, you're welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
I would not want to be one of those 55 people working in the digital COVID-19 certificate call centre because they have coped with 34,000 calls yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, now, even though the government has said that they've added a second number and are looking to increase the number of people working that line from around the 55 upwards to 90, it's still a huge number. I mean, look, you have to look to where the government, did they underestimate the desire for people to get away?
I would imagine grossly, yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, the thing is or alternatively, is that, I mean, you can get into conspiracies and say that, you know, that they're deliberately trying to dampen down expectations and trying to put people off from going away.
Are people saying that?
There is. Look, I mean, they've warned against international travel. We've had minister after minister all year saying, oh, no, we're going to really write off international travel until next year. We're going to write it off until Christmas. You had Leo Varadkar not 2 months ago saying that, look, we've even have a question mark over whether people who are abroad will be able to get home for Christmas. All of these things suggest a government that are very uncomfortable with the idea of international travel.
I would imagine, and perhaps I'm being too kind and not kind enough, that the situation that we find ourselves in at the moment is more a matter of organisation and logistics rather than perhaps a state sense that no, we want you all to stay at home.
Well, I would not disagree with you, I think, but I also would argue that the two are perhaps interlinked. I mean, look, it's worth recognising that Ireland was the last country to introduce the EU digital COVID cert. Every other country in the EU had theirs up and going from the 1st of July. And as we know, Ireland started sending them out to vaccinated people from last Monday, but only came into effect from this Monday last, on the 19th. Now, there are specific reasons, and we are not the only country that has had problems with COVID certs. I know, for instance, I have family relations in Italy who are struggling, and there's no helpline that they can call to find out where their COVID cert is. So it's not just unique to Ireland, sort of, and it's worth pointing that out. However, there is that lack of organization suggests to me that they grossly underestimated the pent-up desire for people to get away.
And also, if I may, and I say this in the most positive sense humanly possible, the collective stubbornness of the people who live in Ireland. One of them particularly, Sean Martin, has tweeted you and I, Fionn, saying, I've been on hold for 5 hours and 15 minutes so far today trying to get his cert. People are not hanging up. They're not walking away from these calls.
No. And look, I mean, Sean is more stubborn and has infinitely greater patience than I would have. And so I applaud him for that. Two things to bear in mind. One, again, pent-up desire. Most of us haven't left the island for over 15 months. Now, travel is not some kind of excessive luxury that we can, you know, a frippery that we can add to the end of the working week. Travel, we are an island people that get away. Like, travel is an inherent part of who we are. And it's not just that this idea of, like, people want to indulge in some kind of extravagant holiday is, and it's not just about getting to the beaches of Spain. It's about going to see friends and family abroad. It's about reconnecting with relations that you haven't seen in perhaps 2 years. This is part of the reason why travel is so important to the Irish. So I sincerely hope that Sean does get an answer.
Yeah, me too. And reward his tenacity, if nothing else.
Absolutely. And I will say this. I don't hold... Like you said at the top, I really feel for those 55, 60, 70, whatever people...
Oh, it must be
that
awful.
That are manning these numbers because they're dealing... Can you imagine if you've had a two-hour wait and then you get on... And there's plenty of reasons why people are calling.
Yeah.
Not only the fact that they haven't received their cert, but in some cases people have said, look, my Christian name is wrong or my date of birth is wrong. How can you send me out another one, you know? And I've booked a holiday. We're off next week. Are you going to get it to me before I go? You know, it's a very stressful time for people.
And I would imagine that many of those people answering those calls are dealing with callers who are understandably like briars. But I suppose focusing on the call centre is to overlook, Fionn, the tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people at this juncture who have already received their certs through email.
Okay, so, I mean, in a sense, as much as one may be critical of the organisation, like the preparedness to get people ready to receive these things, it is worth noting that as of last Monday, there were 1.9 million Irish people who were vaccinated and therefore entitled to receive their vaccine cert. 1 million vaccine certs have been sent out, either by email or through the post. And that's not an inconsiderable amount of vaccine cert. So it is worth highlighting this too. I think when you add this to, there is a fundamental frustration is that we are now the 21st of July. Like, the summer is nearly over and, you know, school holidays will end in the whatever it is, the first or second week in September. And the thing is this is a narrow window for people who want to get away. And so the idea, and whilst many people will say, look, you know, I've given up the ghost for this year, I'm going to postpone until next year, there are hundreds of thousands of people who said no. It's like, I'm desperate to get away this summer. We were told that non-essential travel was going to be possible from the 19th of July. Therefore, I have booked my holiday for the 1st of August.
So, well, what can they do, really, Fionn, if they don't receive it by email or if there's some kind of error that they need to be rectified and they need to make contact with the hotline? Do they just grin and bear it and put up with the wait?
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, yes. Now, it is worth pointing out is that you don't need a DCC for international travel. It is not a mandatory document. It is a document that will facilitate international travel. But let's say, for example, you have been vaccinated. You have your vaccination certificate from the HSE. Nominally, that is valid as proof of vaccination. Now, I also want to point out that I'm sure you've seen it in the news that a couple of nights ago there was a flight that arrived into Malta and 25 or so Irish citizens who didn't have their DCC but did have their HSE vaccination cert were denied the entry or were told that they would have to quarantine because the Maltese authorities didn't recognise the the HSE vaccination cert. Now, Oisin Smith, Minister of State, who is in charge of this, has said they are aware of this, they are trying to resolve it. Malta is a strange case, and I don't mean strange as in weird.
Yeah.
What I mean is that Malta has been, like ourselves, has adopted incredibly stringent rules over entry, and only last week Malta had declared that they were only going to allow in vaccinated people. And then the European Commission criticised them and said, look, this goes against the spirit of the digital COVID cert, which, as we all know, isn't just for vaccinated people. It's also for people who've had a PCR test or a negative PCR test and people who've recovered from COVID. So the Maltese authorities quickly changed their tone and said, OK, fine, we're going to recognise the DCC. I think the people that flew in to Malta on Monday night are victims of timing and circumstance, and that this issue is going to be resolved in the coming days.
Well, let's hope certainly for them and for any other intending passengers to Malta from Ireland. That's Fionn Davenport, Editor-in-Chief of the Irish Travel and Trade Network. Thank you for joining us there. A central bank study released today has found companies penalise insurance customers for their loyalty. On average, long-term car insurance customers are charged 14% more than those renewing for the first time, while loyal home insurance customers pay on average 32% more. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Gráinne McAvoy. She's Director for Consumer Protection at the Central Bank. Gráinne, you're welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Kira. Good afternoon.
There's a lot of really notable things about this report. The first is the fact of penalising people who are electing to give you their business over a period of often many years. And the second is the scale of that penalisation.
Indeed, I suppose what we've published today is our the finalisation and our conclusion of our review, which we commenced 18 months ago, on the whole area of differential pricing. And what we found is differential pricing practices can, in some instances, result in unfair outcomes for some consumers. So as you rightly note, what we're introducing is a number of measures, but one of which is to ban the practice of price walking. So in effect, this will end the loyalty penalty that is being imposed on some customers of motor and home insurance, particularly those who remain with their insurer for quite a long number of years and they don't switch insurance providers regularly. Other changes we're introducing seek to enhance and strengthen the consumer protection framework by introducing transparency measures for consumers and also additional requirements for the firms that we regulate.
I note, Gráinne, that you use the term there are some customers. How would a person know if their insurance company is applying those levies effectively, although they're not that by name, to their home or motor insurance premiums?
That's a really good question, Kira, and I suppose it's one of the findings from our review, which captured and took into account a very detailed survey of over 5,500 customers. And one of the findings were that in many instances, customers do not know. So one of the changes that we're introducing today, which we're consulting on, is to enhance transparency and make it more clear to consumers that if they avail and get a discount as a new business customer, that it's clearly signalled as such to that customer. It's important to note that not all customers who remain loyal to firms are charged that loyalty penalty, and for that reason we use the language of some, because some customers who are loyal can still get discounts from their insurers. What we're seeking to ensure here is across the board that the penalty is done away with, but we still retain the ability for customers who are quite active in the market to seek out that new business discount, which is a really common feature of insurance sector.
Because if you or I, Gráinne, were one of that cohort who is facing a 32% increase on home insurance premiums, or an average of that, and 14% on private motor insurance premiums, that is a significant sum in any given year.
It is. I suppose it's important to put that in context and say that the 14% and 32% really relates to customers who remain with their insurers for 9 years or more. But I guess what's quite important here and the outcome of this work is to draw attention to that and to, through central bank intervention, to ban that practice of price walking, where customers who do remain loyal to their insurer don't incur that loyalty penalty. And that's for that reason that's one of the outcomes of our report today.
Now, you're moving in the central bank, Gráinne, to end this practice. How long will creating the protocols to enable you to do that take?
So while we published the final report today, part of that report actually is a suite of policy proposals that we propose to introduce. So part of the report captures a public consultation on the specific measures that we would like to introduce, and that consultation will remain open until October. Our intention thereafter, taking into account the views of stakeholders, is to finalise these measures early next year, and that they will apply to the insurance sector from the 1st of July next year.
In theory, Gráinne, and I don't know if it falls under your auspices to be able to answer this question, so feel free to decline to do so if it doesn't. Could a person ring up their insurance company, be it a home or a private motor, and say, are you applying this additional charge or electing not to apply discounts?
By all means, an individual customer can engage with their insurer and can ask those questions. I suppose more importantly is that while doing so, they can also engage and ask and see can they negotiate a discount on a bilateral basis as well. But I expect firms have been asked that question and are very open and transparent as to whether or not they have placed a loyalty penalty on the premium that they charge those customers.
Well, Gráinne McEvoy, Director for Consumer Protection at the Central Bank of Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us there. What do you think of that, a loyalty penalty on some home and private motor insurance premiums as outlined by the Central Bank? Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97. Now, new research by Five Rights Foundation has found that teenage girls who even briefly engage with fitness-related content on Instagram are being targeted with weight loss content. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Philip Arneil. He's out of Education and Innovation at CyberSafe Kids. Philip, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hello.
That is really, really disturbing. What kind of targeting are we talking about?
Well, I think it's probably worth saying from the off that, you know, all social media platforms really are about, you know, getting us engaged, keeping us on there, keeping us busy, and getting us liking and following things. So, you know, that's the aim of all the platforms. And then obviously, based on what you're doing on there, all these algorithms are working in the background to suggest content. And of course, that can be positive in some ways, in the sense that, you know, you're getting things that you're interested in, you're connecting with like-minded people. But obviously, the flip side of that is that there may also be content that's maybe inappropriate, or indeed content such as the stuff that's come up in this particular research, which is things like maybe eating disorders, extreme diets, self-harm and suicide. And this kind of content is also, as we all know, online and on the internet and on these platforms. And so it's being suggested as well. So I think within the context of this particular research, you know, even looking at sort of dieting or fitness type sites are sort of flagging up this kind of interest in that content. And then some of the accounts in this research were then being sent down the road of slightly more extreme content. So it's that kind of targeting, really. And it's very much a part of being online. And you know, everything that we do on there is building up a picture of who we are and what we like. And unfortunately, then this kind of content's being targeted at, in some cases, children, as we've seen from this research.
And so it means, in theory, Philip, that, you know, 15-year-old girl could go on to the Instagram account of X, Y, or Z athleisure or gym clothes, just to say, oh well, I'm interested in those leggings, like a couple of posts, and then thereafter find that they're being targeted with this kind of weight loss content. The difference there would be, I would imagine, Philip, that if you or I are on Instagram, it takes it a little while to build up its algorithmic understanding of our likes and dislikes, and we don't find ourselves targeted by particular kinds of content unless or until a pattern of usage emerges.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, I think, you know, we think of algorithms maybe in human terms, but obviously, you know, these are supercomputers that are building up these profiles. So that's why we often get the sense of, you know, our phones are listening to us, because it's not also, and that's not happening, of course, but it's also worth remembering that it's not just our behavior, it's the behavior of the people that we like and that we follow, and friends and family and other things that we've done online as well. So this picture, I think, can be certainly built up very, very quickly. And so I think there's sort of two ways to tackle this. You know, one is that we've got to continue to put pressure on these platforms. And it's probably worth saying it's not just Instagram, you know, Facebook, TikTok, and other platforms as well are also guilty of this. So putting this pressure on for more ethical design, more age-appropriate design is one thing. And then I think also educating children and young people about what they see online. So if you're looking about, if you're thinking about things like distorted body image and image manipulation, you know, making sure that children, young people develop this kind of skepticism about what they see, understanding that things are filtered, things are lit differently, things can be changed with platforms like Photoshop and so on and so forth. And I think tackling it from both those angles means that at least if young people and children do come across this content, then they have, you know, more resilience and these skills to kind of maybe put it to the side or realize that it's not necessarily a reflection of reality or a positive direction in which to be going.
I think the difficulty, and this difficulty applies to everybody regardless of your age cohort, if you're a social media user in any way, is that if you're constantly seeing images of perfection or a particular body type or what have you, you know intellectually that these have been edited, you know they've been photoshopped, you know they've been filtered until almost the cows come home, but emotionally your reaction is very different, and I imagine that that feeling is amplified for a teenage girl.
Yes, I think so completely. And I think it's also important to put it into a wider context that, you know, we've always been looking at distorted images. You know, you go right back, you can see examples of this being done in dark rooms, you know, almost 100 years ago, where people are changing images quite dramatically. The difference, of course, now is the ease and the ubiquity of it. And, you know, we live in a visual world. So I think that probably speaks also to this idea of just making sure that you establish some kind of balance in your life in terms of how much time you're spending online. Because, you know, social media and the online world, a lot of it is designed simply to advertise. You know, it's the world's biggest shop. And so we're on there all the time. And so I think being aware of how much time you're spending online, at least I think will help to mitigate how, you know, this insidious effect of seeing this kind of image. And there's no doubt about it, you know, seeing images and seeing how other people are living their lives and so on and so forth, it does have that impact on our mental health. It does have that impact on our self-esteem. And we've all been through that, children or adults, you know, we're looking at other people thinking, you know, how are they doing so well in lockdown? You know, how are they living
with their beautifully
life?
Curated feed?
Absolutely, yeah. And so understanding that everything, you know, in the same way when you go into a museum or a gallery, everything you're seeing is deliberately chosen. It's very much the same online. And so having that kind of, you know, we're talking about in terms of this digital media literacy, understanding how to read the online world and perhaps see through the surface and understand what's going on behind there is a really important skill for children and young people.
Well, Philip Arneil, Head of Education and Innovation at CyberSafe Kids, thank you indeed for joining us. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking to Assistant Garda Commissioner Paula Hillman about the fact that incidents of hate crime can now be reported on the Garda website. Now, Gardaí have today launched a new way for people to report hate crime, and it's via garda.ie. To tell us all about it, I'm joined on the line by Assistant Garda Commissioner Paula Hillman. Paula, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you for having me.
And we're delighted to do so. This is really a new departure in terms of how people may report hate crime, and I would imagine in part it's because of the underreporting of these kinds of crimes.
Well, exactly, Ciara. That's one of the reasons. We recognise that hate crime is an underreported crime, not just in Ireland, but it's recognised internationally that it is. And in line with really international best practice, we want to look at offering various mechanisms, various ways that victims of hate crime can report the crime or incident that they've been involved in. So they can still go into their local Garda station, they can telephone 112 or 999 in emergency, and from today then they can go onto the Garda website, as you said, garda.ie, and they can report a non-emergency call and report a hate crime to us by that means as well.
And that is a really important point. If it is an emergency, you do contact 999, don't go to the website.
That's it indeed, yes. The website is not monitored 24/7. That is not what it's for. It's still 999 or 112 for an urgent non-emergency call. Undoubtedly, yes, that's an important message. But some people will want to report something that's happened, even if it's happened some time ago. Mm. They don't want to go into the Garda station, and this gives them the facility to speak to us, or if they want to get in contact with perhaps we've Garda diversity officers in every division. Now, their names are also on our website, but sometimes they perhaps just want to speak to us about something, and they can contact us that way as well.
I know most people will be familiar with the term hate crime, but may not have an understanding of what that means in real terms. Could you take us through that, Paula?
Yes, certainly, Ciara. Yes, our definition of hate crime was launched in 2019, or updated in 2019, as part of our diversity and integration strategy. So all the work that I'm talking about today is really being delivered as part of that strategy. And what a hate crime is, and a hate incident, which doesn't reach a criminal threshold, but a hate crime, it's any criminal offence. So experience would show that many of them will be assaults or criminal damage, but it can be any offence. And the offence happens, and it is perceived by the victim or any other person, that person could be a Garda member as well, so the mm-hmm. victim or another person, that the offence has been motivated by hostility or prejudice based on one of nine characteristics that we have identified. And I'll just list those for your listeners. They are age, disability, race, colour, nationality, ethnicity, religion, sexual orientation, or gender. So that definition is one that's been developed, again, looking at international practice and what happens in other jurisdictions. So it is quite an internationally recognised definition. What you'd see in various other countries is perhaps the list of characteristics is different. It's more relevant to the the jurisdiction, to the country that the definition is being implemented in. And for us in Ireland, we had identified those nine.
And Paula, when somebody makes a report on the Garda website using this new facility launched today, what happens next?
Yes, well, today it is very much part of a wider campaign of Let's Stop Hate Together. So people are encouraged to report hate crime. And tomorrow, if I could just say, tomorrow is European Day of Action in support of victims of hate crime. So that's why we chose today to really, as a date to launch this. We were always going to launch it, but we launched it to coincide with the European Day of Action tomorrow. They will report it on our website. We have a National Diversity and Integration Unit, which I have responsibility for, and they're based in Dublin. Initially, the report will come in to our centralised unit. Now, they will assess it, they will see what the content is and take action as appropriate. If it requires investigation or it requires action locally, it will be then given to the local division and will be investigated, or if some engagement's required by the local division where the crime or incident has happened. If it's something perhaps that they can deal with at a more national level, or something that the national unit can deal with, they will deal with it. But in terms of the a local crime or a matter that will be dealt with locally by local divisional officers, divisional members, and Garda diversity officers. We have diversity officers in every division across the country. We've about 310 at the minute, and they are mostly attached to our community policing teams, but they're trained to support and actively engage with minority, diverse and hard to reach communities, but they also will support investigations and work with our victims' offices to support victims of hate crime.
Now, some 238 hate crimes reported between January and June of this year. That's over 100 more than in the same period in 2020, when, of course, there were quite high-level COVID-19 restrictions in being. Do you anticipate, Paula, that were you and I to be speaking this time next year, that 238 figure would have increased significantly?
Well, that is really the aim of part of this campaign and the other work we're doing. You know, very much in this area, this is not just a policing issue. It is a wider societal issue as well. But in terms of our responsibilities as the National Police Service, when we are engaging with, we have a National Diversity Forum, so when we're engaging with the many groups that represent the diverse minority communities, you know, we hear from them regularly that people want to report a hate crime for various reasons. They maybe came from a country where they it wasn't a community-centric policing service that we have, and the trust in policing, they feel that nothing will be done, or they don't know how to report it. So there are various barriers to reporting, and that's why we also work very closely with the many organisations nationally and locally to encourage people, if they wish, to report that hate crime to an Garda Síochána. We want to make it visible. We want to be able to rightly hold people to account for actions which have reached a criminal threshold. So, you know, by doing that, one of the other areas of work we're doing is to encourage in those third-party referrals. So with the victim's permission, you know, some of the partnership groups that we work with will be able to also forward a referral with the victim's agreement. So, yes, for us, actually, what we want to see is that increased reporting and that confidence in Garda Síochána. The figures that we released today are just a snapshot. We have more work to do. We are going to use this year as a baseline. We did some work, some IT. We enhanced our IT, our recording mechanism. So we actually want to look right across the year to get a more accurate estimate of the reporting of hate crime. But again, I think for us, and listening to the victims and listening to those who represent them, yes, that we know it's underreported and people have the confidence to come forward, you know, and report it. We don't want people to suffer in silence. Please, you know, if you have been a victim, we are here to help. You know, our message, our hashtag and our key message today is let's stop hate together. So let's do that, and please report it to an Garda Síochána.
Well, Assistant Garda Commissioner Paula Hillman, thank you indeed for your time.